find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at KaleidoScience, Conversations on Cognitive Science. This episode is hosted by Lisa Palmer and Sönke Löw.
Welcome to the third episode in our blog on modeling the brain. And for today's episode, we once again want to talk about the connection between neuroscience and computer science. And for that, we have invited junior professor Pascal Nitas from the University of Osnabrück. He specializes in neurocomputing and computational neuroscience and machine learning. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, we play our short get-to-know game, where I give you five sentences and ask you to finish them. The first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be.
It's a surprisingly long pause, because I really didn't know as a kid.
When did you start to have an idea, or did it just occur by coincidence and then you ended up in a position you're happy in?
Where I ended up with was a bunch of coincidences. Maybe the in-between step, just after finishing school and after civil service, I studied law for a little bit, applied at the police, decided that's not the right thing for me, and taking 2-3 corners, I ended up at cognitive science.
Interesting. Our second sentence. If I was an emoji, I would be?
Sort of flat-faced.
Also flat eyes, straight or just flat mouth?
No, just flat mouth.
Third sentence. My favorite thing to do on a day off is?
Nothing nowadays. Walk in the forest. It's very good. Spending time with the family.
That sounds good, yeah. Fourth sentence. Right now, I'm most fascinated by?
Still the brain.
Just the brain. Anything?
Yeah, generally speaking. Well, I could be more specific, but then the sentence, me finishing the sentence would become really long. I think we'll talk about it today.
Okay. And our last sentence is, I know it's time to call it a day when?
When you start sort of getting a little bit dizzy just sitting in your seat, that's not a good sign. You better stop then.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much for your answers. I would now ask you to just tell us a bit. You already mentioned you first started at law school and then ended up in cognitive science, but what happened in between and how you ended up as junior professor at Osnabrück University?
Yeah, so the as I said, coming out of school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I wasn't the most, wasn't the greatest pupil, let's say, specifically in terms of homework and those sort of stuff wasn't really my thing. So I came out a little without orientation, tried out law, really wasn't my thing. Thought, well, maybe then police is maybe a thing that maybe might be more interesting. Applied there, but then already during the application also applied for cognitive science through which my now wife actually was interested in studying and then decided against, but thought maybe this is the thing. So I started with a very clear focus that I thought I always liked programming. I started programming at like 14 or so with a little bit of basic Pascal. And then thought, well, cognitive science might be my path to become a programmer with a little bit extra, right? With a little bit more sort of maybe an AI programmer or something like that. As many of my generation, I did play computer games and I thought, well, maybe I can write the next great AI for a computer game or something like that. During school, for example, that I ended up in neuroscience is actually kind of weird because at school, I was able to get rid of one of the sciences for my final exams, and biology was the one I got rid of, specifically because the section on neurobiology. Because school books in particular have this, I think they have to, right? They sell certainty, right? I think that's a big mistake that we're making, but nevertheless, almost all science presented outside of academia is presented with a high degree of certainty. And the fact that this book wanted to tell me what a thought is by explaining how protein channels are supposed to work in a single neuron was a complete disconnect and just utterly stupid. It really got on my nerves. So I did not want to have anything to do with biology at that point. And that's the way I started studying too. And it was only towards, my first focus in studying cognitive science here in Osnabrück actually. Was on computational linguistics and artificial intelligence and those kinds of courses. a little bit of math. But I did happen to like neuroinformatics, sort of statistics, that particularly because there was math involved, it was sensible for me. I could track it, I could follow it, it made sense to me. And through that, found a mentor in Gordon Pieper here, basically, who then encouraged me to continue to study, basically. So I'm not from a family with lots of academics in the family. I'm sort of the first one that went to uni. Although my father is an engineer, but in Germany, the system is slightly different. So it's a very different world if you go to a Fachhochschule or Hochschule in Germany versus a university. It's not very academic at all. So there was no academicians. So my idea was, well, I get a bachelor and then I got a job. And I had this guy that thought, well, maybe you can do a little bit more. Basically, the way my mentor worked was he just assumed that I'm going to do a PhD before I finished my bachelor thesis. It was just, that's what he thought. And he didn't ask me if I wanted to or anything like that. He just said, and then you're going to do your PhD, maybe with me or maybe somewhere else. No, that's the first time that thought really entered my head that I could be one of these people that get a PhD. So I finished my master's. Around my master's, I had a short stint at IBM for a internship, which I liked, but I was already sort of on track to doing my PhD, which started on a fellowship provided by IBM, so a stipend. And then I switched to sort of different positions here at the university, financing myself through my PhD with Gordon Pieper and the neuroinformatics group. Pretty quickly already, halfway through at the latest, I guess, I already started focusing in to become more biological than I thought. I started very much in the artificial neural network world, more abstract models. And I'm sure we'll get to this later, but a certain frustration sort of kicked in. There was things, the models that didn't do that I thought they should be able to do in terms of what they can explain, how accurate they are to reality, how efficient they are, all these questions, that together with a still very good friend of mine, Johannes Leugering, who was my sort of PhD buddy, topic-wise at the very least, we started looking really deeply into what the single neuron does, what the biology tells us, what the state of the art is. So that's sort of where I ended up now. Doing my PhD. My PhD is still a potpourri of different themes. So there's the single neuron model is in there, lots of biology. It's also just machine learning and different dynamical systems models. So methodologically, I almost always have something to do with machine learning and some dynamical system stuff. That was pretty clear already during my master's and that stayed with me. So that's sort of, and then I got kind of lucky that there was a junior professorship available around the time when I finished my PhD that fit my topic. And I guess I got also a little bit lucky. This junior professorship is financed that I'm on right now. It's not financed by the university itself, but by a third party, by the Volkswagen Foundation, generously, which is great on the one hand. But on the other hand, that means in the German academic system, there is no follow-up position for me, right? So I do not have a tenure track junior professorship, which makes it a little less attractive. So I sort of have a deadline now for another 3.5 years or so, where I need to be on a full professorship or drop out of academia. And things collided so that even though I was very early on in my career, I was able to get onto this position. And I've been here now for just over 2 years, 2 years and a bit.
Yeah, thanks. You've already just mentioned some terms I just want to get back to before we go deeper.
Yeah.
Also, because I personally am not in the whole machine learning neuroinformatics section, so I quite early already decided, well, that's not my main area of expertise. Can you maybe just really shortly explain what difference is in artificial neural networks, deep learning, so those traditional machine learning approaches are, and how far they're also different to a more neuron-based approach, which you are more focusing on, as far as I know?
Yeah. So nowadays, deep learning has become a standard term for artificial neural networks generally. But really, the origin is an artificial neural network is just something that models a neural network that is artificial, right? So everything falls under artificial neural network. The deep learning kind means that in any neural network, you can have multiple stages of processing. So there'll be some sort of input will be processed in the first, what we call a layer, the second layer, the third layer, etc. And for a long time, training neural networks that had many of these layers, say more than 3, 4 even, turned out to be quite difficult. And starting around sort of 2008 and then through 2010, 2011, people figured out techniques that had to do with lots of compute and lots of data and these kinds of things to be able to train artificial neural networks that had 2, 3, 4, 5, or now 50, 100, or even more of these so-called layers of processing stages. That turned out to be hugely successful in machine learning and modeling input-output relationships. But these networks were then called deep neural networks compared to shallow neural networks, which we were able to train before 2008 or so. So that's the only distinction there. But because so many different techniques have now grown out of this, is that deep learning has become a much, much wider term. So a transformer looks very different from a traditional artificial neural network and requires more work to try and compare it to what the brain does, for example. The other distinction that is probably worth mentioning is that the artificial neural network that most people talk about means that your input and the output of each of these processing stages is usually what you would call a real valued vector. So a long list of numbers, and the numbers are, for example, between -1 and 1 or something like that, like decimal numbers. That is theoretically and computationally often much simpler, but the brain doesn't directly, at the very least, communicate from neuron to neuron by sending a number 0.358. Right? It sends a spike. At one point in time, the neuron generates an action potential that travels down the axon, excites the postsynaptic neuron, and that's the information transmission. Theoretical and computational models that use this mechanism for communication between neurons is what we call a spiking neural network. And that's sort of the area that I mostly work on. I also use artificial neural networks. I don't use a lot of models that would realistically should be called deep learning. So the artificial neural network models I use are often a little bit simpler, but we're branching out now there as well. So that's sort of the framework of it. All the new stuff that you hear about in the news about AI is usually what people would consider deep learning or deep neural networks. The thing that came before that is an artificial neural network as a set of methodologies in machine learning, i.e. Not writing a program, but learning a program from data. And the special area there that I find particularly interesting and exciting are spiking neural networks, where the individual neurons in these networks that do the computational layers, the step-by-step processing, communicate by spiking and without sending real valued numbers.
What does spiking mean?
Spiking is really just the name of the process of action potential generation. So every nerve cell in our brain has near the... So it's actually quite helpful to imagine an actual tree, like an apple tree, right? It has a huge arbor, dendritic arbor at the top, has a trunk in the center, then there are still a bunch of roots to the side, right? And then you can imagine from sort of there's a root knot at the center there where an additional cable, imagine would be a cable coming out, right? This cable is what would transmit information to other neurons in this sense, right? The tree is the neuron in this picture. And the around this root knot where the sort of outgoing cable starts is where neurons generate action potentials, right? So every neuron has a membrane potential difference to its surroundings, right? So it keeps a negative electrical potential. But if there's a certain amount of input collected through all the leaves and all the other roots of the tree, they arrive at the root knot. And if this crosses a certain threshold, a mechanism of a couple of these ion channels opening and closing in very complicated nonlinear ways will mean that this depolarization sort of vanishes and the neuron depolarizes, right? So if you were to track the voltage over time, you would see that the membrane potentially suddenly shoots up and shoots back down again and goes back to what we call resting potential, the standard state of the neuron. And this process of action potential generation is what we call a spike, and is what then travels through this cable from this one neuron to all the other neurons and excites them in their root and leaf nodes, right? So that's what we call a spike. And in more computational or more computer terms, this literally means it's an event in time So it's not even really a binary event, a one or zero. It's literally just a one at any particular point in time, right? So the neuron is, the standard way to look at it is quiescent. It doesn't do anything. But then after, say, 0.789 milliseconds or so, it generates a spike. So it sends out one event, and then it's quiescent again.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the code that we're interested in then.
Two episodes ago, we talked to Professor Kietzmann, and he said something that I never thought about, but somehow it seemed very clear afterwards. He said that in an artificial neural network, one unit or one neuron does not necessarily correspond to a single neuron in the brain, but maybe like a group of neurons. If you now like have an even closer resemblance for the biological neuron in your artificial neurons, does that change anything about that? Or is does like one spiking neuron in an artificial spiking network still represent like potentially more than one biological neuron?
So that's actually a little bit complicated, and it's an ongoing topic of discussion. To answer your question directly, I think the second you make the transition to a spiking neuron, it's much harder to argue that your one spiking neuron is in reality a group of spiking neurons. It's still possible, right? You would then say a usual neuron might fire 2 to 10 to maybe 20 times a second or so. And now your artificial spiking neuron fires at, I don't know, 100 or 200 times a second or so. That's unrealistic, but maybe that's the output of a group of neurons, right, that you all summarize together. And to what degree the single computational unit, so the artificial neuron, whether it's spiking or not, corresponds to a real neuron is unknown at the moment. So it's pretty clear that it's definitely not one unit in an artificial neural network, right? In a deep learning, one activation, like one output of one of these processing stages, that doesn't correspond to a single neuron in the brain with I would say, pretty high likelihood. But once you go to the spiking domain, it becomes a little bit less clear. Right. So the in the picture right now that I told you about this tree where there's a cable coming out of sort of this root knot and then there are all these branches at the top and then all the other roots that in theory in a real neuron and a pyramidal neuron, this is how pyramidal neurons look to be specific, a bunch of different types of neuron. But in a pyramidal neuron, we are at that point, the most common model in theoretical models ignores the trunk, the leaves, all of the roots, everything, and reduces everything down to just this root knot where it generates an action potential, and the very outside edges where synapses contact axons from other neurons, right? So receive input from other neurons, and we ignore how the signal comes from very far away leaf node, the synapse, all the way down to this root knot where the action potential is generated. That process is usually completely ignored, right? In reality, we know, especially in the last 20 years or so, this has come to light, that there are lots and lots of things going on in real neurons across this entire tree structure. And then the question becomes, how much of that do you need to model to accurately capture the computational capabilities of that neuron? And you could very well make the argument that, well, a real neuron might really be 2, 3, 4 spiking neurons, or 2, 3, or 4 artificial neurons. You don't need the implementation to be equivalent to have a good model, right? That's perfectly fine. Your artificial model will also, is very unlikely to gain any new capabilities now that you're saying there's a 1 to 5 or 5 to 1 or some sort of that relationship, right? If I, in my artificial neural network, can just put in 5 neurons and then I have the equivalent of a real neuron or something like that, well, I'm just putting in any number that doesn't look like the real number of neurons anyway. So that doesn't matter. Right. So the real interesting questions are what happens within this dendritic tree, right? So in neuron, this entire tree structure is called the dendrite, the neural dendrite. What are all the things that happen within this dendrite that do something more than just adding an additional node in your artificial neural network? Because that from the theory side doesn't do anything, right? You're still in the realm of neural networks. You still have this very simple computational units that you talked about with Tim, that you then combine to, for example, multiple layers, as I talked about earlier, to learn some sort of complicated computation. Well, just having more, we probably, if you have 200, 300 layers or something like that, that's fine. But maybe that's just, in reality, that's just 20 or 30 layers, because 10 neurons are really just one neuron in the brain. It doesn't fundamentally change anything. But these other sort of active dendritic mechanisms that I care a lot about, those do, I think, change things and bring with them a lot of puzzles at the moment.
I'm always wondering, when it comes to more brain-focused approaches to of modeling, or modeling the brain approaches in general, how much neuroscience is actually involved in developing algorithms? So how much of the brain do you think about, and how many things that are known do you think about when figuring out possible solutions that are algorithmically based?
That depends very much on your particular goal and at what level you want to describe something. So, for example, closer to the deep learning world, specifically in image recognition, the comparisons are usually, your data comparison at the very least, is usually on the level of an fMRI study or something like that, where you might have a cubic millimeter voxels somewhere in the brain, which already you know contain a multitude of neurons, and you're sort of trying to get an estimate of the activity by measuring blood oxygen, right? These Bolt responses. And you can compare on that level to, for example, figure out what roughly goes on in a big area of the brain, how other big areas of the brain connect to each other, how information travels on these sort of larger macroscopic networks. On the very other end of the scale, where I mostly live, you're trying to, you really want to dig into the neurobiology. So what are the biophysical sort of principles underneath your model? So we don't do direct biophysical modeling here as well, because you can, for example, go ahead and like within this complicated single neuron structure and a pyramidal neuron, this tree, along the trunk, along the branches, there are a bunch of little of these ion channels that manage the voltage potential between the inside of the neuron and the outside of the neuron, which is very important for a whole bunch of different processes, mainly the computation. And you can go ahead and try and model all of these, right? There are people who very carefully scan these pyramidal neurons in slices and try to reconstruct them so that they can then put them into a computational simulation. But you then have such a complicated model that it's very hard to learn anything more abstract, right? It's hard to see the forest for the trees. But what we try to do is we sort of try to hit the middle ground there to look at the biology, to look at the biophysical modeling, and try to make sure that the models that we build sort of match reality in exactly those questions that we care about. One example, for example, is plasticity or learning in general, where the theory that machine learners use to train a deep neural network or an artificial neural network, the algorithm that is usually used is called backpropagation. It's a mathematical algorithm where you take the derivative of a error function at the output, right? So you put your input in, go through the entire network. At the output, you figure out how big the error the network made is. And from this measurement of the error, you can then figure out through calculus how you need to change every single connection in your network just a little bit to get closer to your desired output. And this mechanism of figuring out how to change every single weight requires you, A, for example, you do it for only one data example, right? So you see one image, you have one output, and for that input-output pair, you do all the adjustments, right? And you have to calculate backwards through the network as well, to figure out if you start in layer one, for example, if you want to change very early on in your network a weight, one of these connections from one neuron to another that changes the computational properties of your network, you're sort of taking into account all the stuff that happens in the computation after it as well. That's a real problem for biology, because there's no known way how biology could figure that out, right? There is no magical computer attached to your brain that does this algorithm for you and then tells the synapse, oh, you have to grow or you have to shrink. Right, so when you want to write plasticity algorithms, you care a lot about what variables are involved. It doesn't have to be one-to-one. For example, the size of the synaptic response of one neuron, given that the presynaptic neuron fired, Depends on the size of a spine head, usually, which is a little protrusion of the dendritic spine, where a bunch of these AMPA channels, is what they're called, which react to glutamate release at the presynapse. So this entire biochemical process going on there. The channels open up and something happens. And really the size of the EPSP, for example, depends on the number of AMPA channels that are available, right? Well, that's great and all, but that's not really a useful property, but at least that is not really useful in modeling, right? You usually want to abstract that as like a weight. How effective is the connection? So this is a property that you probably know locally, right? You also know what your input was just now. You also, at least we assume, and there are some cracks in this picture already from the neuroscience, but we assume that we also know that what the postsynaptic neuron, your own tree, basically, what you did. Right? So you can correlate what the input was with what the output was. And what you get out of that is the very traditional Hebbian rule. So what wires together fires together. You can figure out when you fire together with your input. So you can increase the weight. What you cannot do is figure out what your output did 10 steps down the line in a computation, get that information locally, and then do an adjustment. But then there are different ways around that, maybe through maybe a reward, and there are a bunch of ideas how we might get around that problem. So this is the sort of stuff that we then start caring about to be closer to the brain while still getting to an abstract model. Because if you can't get to an abstract model, it will be very difficult to learn anything about computational principles. And that's sort of the tricky balance to strike. It connects to the previous question as well, very closely, how much detail you want to put into a single neuron versus how much detail you want in the network, right? So for example, if I'm going to model in a very detailed way a single pyramidal neuron, I can do that. But if they then can only look at the sort of dynamics of this single neuron, that's not really realistic as well, because in the brain, for all the brains that we usually tend to care about, especially in cognitive science, these brains are pretty big. Right. So there is a bunch of other stuff going on around the neuron that isn't neuron, and there are a bunch of other neurons going on at the same time. Right. So you're always making trade-offs, and then it depends on what kind of research question you're trying to answer, whether it's theoretical, which might mean that you have want to do some analysis or explain the mechanism very simply, come up with explanations, or you might want to fit to data, which then puts different requirements on your model. And then it depends on what type of data do you want to fit to. Right? Do you want to fit your model to a very detailed experiment with, for example, calcium to photon imaging in the brain. So in a behaving animal, you're trying to image with a microscope the calcium concentrations, which have some relationship to activity in the neuron, on the level of a single neuron. Or do you want to do it on fMRI, where you get much coarser measurements, temporally not as precise, definitely not as precise in, spatially, even though pretty precise spatially compared to EEG, right? So you then have to go through what am I trying to model? What data do I want to compare to? At what level, sort of, if I'm a theorist like I am, will end up wanting to explain something? At what level do I want this explanation to work? And then you have to start making trade-offs.
One of the things you mentioned when you explained backpropagation, and also maybe in your tree analogy, is that everything in an artificial neural network goes in one direction, and only at the end it goes like backwards, but there is like still this very directed, always pointing forward kind of architecture. Mm-hmm. And I think in the brain that's not necessarily the case, that like everything is like layered in layers. Do you find that is like a problem of the current technology, or is it something that we don't need to model right now? What is your perspective on that?
So it's not a problem for current technologies, because that problem would have to be technological, right? There would have to be something that they cannot solve because they're doing it this way. Currently, I don't see a problem. There are certainly problems in the AI world and in engineering that need to be solved, but I don't see the solution of them to be immediately be to introduce a more complicated layered feed-forward feedback type structure. For if you want to look at the brain, of course, this is different. The fact that the brain does not adhere to a nicely hierarchical structured layout is completely natural, but also, of course, as a theorist, it just makes life more difficult or more exciting, depending on your perspective. The usual story, so layer also means something different in the brain versus what it means in an artificial neural network. In an artificial neural network, a layer means literally one stage of computation. You finish this stage and then you go to the next one. And in Cortex, it's much, much more anatomically defined, right? What types of neurons are there? How do they look and stuff like that? We have the six-layer structures that repeats all throughout cortical regions, right? Where there are particular kinds of pyramidal neurons that live in layer 5. There are particular kinds of pyramidal neurons that tend to live around layer 2-3. And then there are interneurons, all types of neurons, that, right? There's all this anatomical detail you could go through. And connecting this directly to an artificial neural network layered structure doesn't actually make a lot of sense, I think. Additionally, so there's some, for example, we did talk about backpropagation before, and there are a couple of ideas how these feedforward feedback structures in the brain, right, where you do a computation forward, but then there are also, once your set of neurons sends its output to another, usually a region, so from V1 to V4 or something like that, there will be connections, reciprocal connections that project back into your own layer, right, or into your own region, right? And you find this very complicated sort of hierarchical interconnected diagrams for Cortex, right? Lots of boxes with lots of arrows. And there are at least some ideas how a feed-forward feedback type structure could maybe do something like backpropagation at some point, right? So you're sending your signal forward, and then there's a different set of connections that sort of tells you what the processing stage, let's say more abstractly, down the line, what they did, right? And they're telling you what they did through this feedback connection. Right? They're sending you a note, oh, we did this and this with the output that you gave us. We produced this output ourselves. And that's probably a useful learning signal. It doesn't have to be exactly backpropagation. For example, Timothy Lillycrap from DeepMind a couple of years back suggested maybe this backpropagation thing works even if this feedback pass is somewhat random, right? If you do, the algorithm is called random feedback alignment, right? So if from your output, from your error measurement, you just basically do random projections into your network, which are stable, they're not changing, right? And you use that as the information about the error. And it turns out that in some situations, not nearly as robust as backpropagation, but in some situations, this kind of can also work for relatively deep structures, right? So there's definitely a there. But I don't think the research has finished yet. Right? So there's clearly something, if you want to do a more brain accurate model of a neural network, one type of model that will be helpful is probably including these feedback connections. I should probably say the problem that backpropagation solves in the first place is generally called the credit assignment problem, right? So in learning in a distributed network, right, you have all these different neurons, all these different stages of processing, and all these different weights that determine what happens at each of these stages of processing. And the credit assignment problem basically means if you as a neuron, if the network makes an error, whatever error that is, what was your contribution to that error? What's your credit? Did you do a good job? Did you do a bad job? Should you change? Should you be more active or less active the next time around? That's what's called the credit assignment problem. And solving that in a sort of biologically realistic way will very likely involve like these feedforward feedback type connections, I'm pretty sure. I also think biology has a pretty good way of being quite clever without feedback. But yeah, in the bigger picture, this will definitely be part of the equation, but no settled theories as of yet, as far as I can tell.
Another thing that you said earlier when we talked about like these spiking neurons is you brought like time into the picture, and mm-hmm. In like traditional AI, like the computational speed is basically the limiting factor, but you always have like as much time as you want basically for your computation, and it just like then takes longer to go through your training data and things. But in like biology, I think like time plays an essential role, because like the world doesn't wait for you to have finished computing what you see, but you still have to react to it. Is there like a closer resemblance to the biology on this side in like spiking neurons? And is that something that also similar to the recurrence question that needs to be modeled right now, or is that like a problem down the road?
Yeah, that gets into a couple of very important points. So first off, time also plays a role in AI, right? They also have recurrent networks. But the way it usually plays a role, at least for the types of AI applications that I guess are famous, which for the recurrent case usually ends up being language, right? It's not really time as in time in milliseconds, but in time as this syllable occurred before this syllable occurred before this syllable. It's an order of symbols, really. And order seems to be an extremely important principle there. That's sort of a given by time in our everyday life, right? That's sort of what time gives us. One thing happened after the other. And then you have to ask a physicist about the error of time. That's a whole different set of questions. But there are sort of two problems with that. So A is what you said. You can just wait for the computation to finish. And if that takes too long, you find a way to parallelize the computation, buy a bigger computer, and then it's faster. Problem solved. That doesn't work for us. We have to be real time, right? So there's a constant input stream, but we also have to produce an output stream. Sometimes it's fine to think about something a little bit. Sometimes you have to react quickly. So that's one end of the spectrum. The other is, if you are a system that works in real time, you also have to memorize even things that happened just a couple of seconds ago, right? You can't be a purely input-driven system, because if you were, you wouldn't be able to understand me, right? Because sentences only make sense if you remember the stuff that I said before, if they make sense at all, right? So the transformer architecture that has been so popular in deep learning is actually a way to get around that. Right, so a transformer just takes the entire language at once and computes on the entire language at once what the block of language, rather, right, the entire context window, what the response of the model should be. That's not really how we at least traditionally conceptualize computation in real time in brains, right? Instead, you have this problem of working memory at sort of different stages. Right. So let's get back to spiking. In the spiking neural network, this comes up very naturally, because the easiest possible example that I already told you is a little bit wrong, right? Is this idea where you're taking this root node of this tree and you're modeling the spiking output, this action potential generation. And what the other thing that you're modeling is that you're getting these action potentials, these spikes from other neurons as well. Those are the two things, right? But what actually happens is, when you get a spike input, you don't suddenly get all the spike input at once, right? You sort of start integrating. For a time, your membrane potential will rise a little bit, and then it will fall back down a little bit. That's what's called an excitatory postsynaptic potential, right? That's the effect that the neuron has on another neuron. That's the actual piece of information, right? And because they rise up and then fall down again, after, depending on where you would measure in the brain and whether you do so in what's called a slice preparation or in the real brain or whatever, it might be that after 10 milliseconds, a neuron has forgotten that at some synapse, there was an input spike at least on the voltage level. But in order to cross the threshold and generate an action potential itself, it needs to see multiple of these spikes at the same time. Otherwise, it's not going to generate a spike, right? So that already tells you that a bunch of the neurons that are firing at me, if I'm a neuron, they need to either fire a lot so that in a short period of time I can rely on a couple of them being active at the same time, or they have to find some way of temporally organizing themselves and then firing together, right? Because if they arrive at the same time, reliably, they can all, these integration of these EPSPs, first going up and then going down, all happens at the same time. They all go up together, that will be enough to cross the threshold and set an action potential. Okay, so that's the first hurdle. So you're in time naturally anyways, right? And that already puts some sort of constraint into how you receive information, if you receive information in spikes versus in an artificial neural network, that this time put would just be, look at all this information currently at once, please, and do your computation. This is not how it arrives in biology, right? And generally speaking, you don't have super well coordinated inputs, right? There's not like some, there's always this picture of like a conductor in front of an orchestra, right? It's much more a self-organized system, the brain, right? And there's no unit that, well, and people argue, but in most cases, there isn't like one definite sort of click track where every neuron, all of you fire now, go ahead, right? And then the next piece of computation happens. Everything sort of happens at the same time. It's very asynchronous that way. So that's the first problem. You have to solve that if you're a spiking neuron, or if you're a spiking neural network, rather. You have to communicate effectively with each other. And the second problem is, if you're forgetting what happens 10 milliseconds in the past already, right? Sure, you can easily remember what happened. You can sum up a bunch of input spikes after 10 milliseconds, and they might tell you at the same time about different features of your visual input, for example. I don't know. They're all telling you about different stripes, right? And then some of them are telling you about leaves, and the resulting computation tells you that there's a tiger in the bush, right? Great. But after 10 milliseconds, if you've forgotten this again, that seems useless, right? So you then sort of start, you have to extrapolate this time problem more and more and more in terms of how are you actually memorizing the past effectively. Traditionally, the idea is that these networks are connected recurrently, right? So they talk to each other, and not just one layer talks to the next layer, right? Or one processing stage talks to the next processing stage, but rather within a processing stage, all the neurons keep talking to one another, right? So if you're getting an input and you're saying, I saw a tiger, you tell all your friends, I saw a tiger. And 3 or 50 milliseconds in the future, they're going to tell you again, hey, you saw a tiger, by the way, right? And then you keep telling people, I saw a tiger, even though, like, right? And you sort of try to keep in a virtuous cycle, hopefully, the information in the network. Turns out that in our experience, at least, that's not a super robust way of doing things. It's kind of hard to keep all the information in activity like that. And this is where then we get into these more complicated things that happen in dendritic trees. So in this complicated tree-like structure, that's the dendrite of the neuron. And one of these things is that if you happen to get a spike volley, so coordinated inputs, say 4 or 5 spikes actually arriving at the same time, and this can happen quite far away from your actual root node that produces the output at the same time, the dendrite has sort of tools to, at that point, not just, say, summarize these EPSPs and send them forth, and the root node decides whether you should spike or not. Instead, it's going to make a decision locally and say, I've seen something, whatever that might be, right? Maybe that's the tiger or the position in the room or something like that. And it can generate what's called a dendritic plateau potential. So there's a more complicated biophysical process that at that point in time depolarizes, so activates that cell, not for 10 milliseconds, but for 200, 250 milliseconds. That's for a much, much longer time. There's still a debate whether what the signal actually is. In our mind, this is clearly a signal that should be used by any system that has access to a signal like that as a piece of like working memory, or maybe to distinguish it a little bit from working memory in the sense that psychologists use it and use computer terminology. It's almost like a cache memory, right? It's sort of an in-between computation. You're remembering part of your more complicated computation, right? You're storing a bit basically internally, I've already seen the tiger. And then maybe the other piece of computation is, oh, it's actually running at me. And then you're actually going to fire the neuron that says, oh, run away, right? And that's one of these examples where suddenly you have the time scale where neurons communicate with each other in spikes, right? Where the effect is always on the order of 2 to 5, 10, maybe 20, maybe in a slice 40 milliseconds, but that's it. To local decisions within a neuron that remembers one of these decisions for 100, 200, 250 milliseconds, right? And then something happens that's in the network that's completely different from what's inside the neuron. That's, I think, what I think is super exciting, and where I think there is, I'm not sure how much impact this timescale difference has immediately on standard deep neural network ideas, but I think even in a recurrent network, in the artificial neural network sense, this could actually have quite a lot of benefits. But in the spiking context, it's very, very clear what the problem is otherwise. For context, the problem that you run into if you just have a bunch of spiking neurons and you connect them together, right, you build a model, you implement it on a computer to see what happens, and it's a spiking model, and you connect these neurons very strongly to each other, they will end up basically, they will just keep shouting to one another and become louder and louder and louder. And there's no, in a shouting match, all information is lost, right? The flip side is you can weaken all these connections. And then you might shout into the network, but no one's actually going to hear you. So nothing happens. And after a couple of milliseconds or time steps, everyone's just quiet. That is also not very helpful, right? And so this balancing problem is quite difficult to keep information in the network. So for longer periods of time, we think one of the possible solutions is neurons just remember internally. So they don't need everyone to shout at them for 200 milliseconds that the tiger was there. They just remembered that. And then in the future, they can use that piece of information to make further decisions.
Can I just quickly summarize what you've just said? Mm-hmm. To make sure that I understood it correctly. So the difference when you have a plateau potential is that kind of you have an information that you get on hold until you reevaluate that information. Let's say when you saw a tiger, you kind of have information that there was a tiger on hold until you either see the tiger runs away or the tiger moves towards you. And then a new potential comes up and then you reevaluate the situation and make a decision based on that re-evaluation.
Yeah.
In contrast to not having this plateau, where you would constantly be shouting and hyperactively or non-actively at all react to the situation and be a bit like a hyperactive monkey in a cage, where you just run whenever someone shouts, there's a tiger, and then just react for every, well, information you get to some degree.
Although, of course, in biology, almost everything exists. So there are, I think, prefrontal cells, I'm pretty sure, where these plateau potentials directly correspond to, as long as they're active, the neuron is actually just shouting all the time. And so this also occurs. But that's not the general case. Another very easy example I always think is, a model that we actually publish is maybe the computation that happens based on these plateau potentials might also happen sequentially then, right? To get back to this idea of, the information that time really gives you is the order and not necessarily the specific timing. And I think the easiest example for that is speech, right? My speech rhythm might be informative to you in terms of how nervous I am or how anxious, but it doesn't necessarily carry semantic information about the speech content, right? About the utterance. So if I am speaking very slowly, you can still integrate the syllables, right? One after the other. That common sequence, no problem. And if I become a little bit more anxious and start talking very quickly, you can still easily get the syllables one after the other. The information is really only in the order of the syllables, up to a certain degree when there's clearly a pause and there might be a new word starting or something like that. And one of the ideas that we had, and we're still sort of following, is that if you have these local memory traces of I've recognized something, maybe that thing that you recognize is maybe a syllable, right? So along the dendritic tree, as you go from the leaf branches towards the root node, you might have multiple of these segments where you activate one after the other. So the first one is activated by the first syllable, the second by the second, the third by the third, and so on and so forth. And you get a sequence detection within the dendritic tree that doesn't necessarily depend on specific timing anymore. Because these plateaus, when they actually are generated within the dendritic tree, are quite stereotypical, right? So they're long, say 200 milliseconds. And during that 200 milliseconds, they don't change, right? So if you look at a plateau in process, as long as you're not towards the end or the beginning, you can't really tell where you are, right? You can't say, oh, this started 50 milliseconds ago or something like that. It's just literally just a different state. It's as if you've flipped the switch, right? So the next stage basically just is also able to flip on the switch if the first one was already on. And then it doesn't matter whether this I flipped the second switch at the beginning of this first plateau or at the end, right? Whether I'm speaking very quickly or quite slowly. And that's a mechanism that can alleviate a little bit of this pressure, particularly in spiking neural networks that you'd have in simpler models where you need to coordinate your timing a bunch more. Right, where you then in a sequence would have to make sure that the sequence elements come in a particular rhythm so that all the information is still available in the network to keep processing. Right, and if there's a longer break, suddenly all the neurons go silent again and everyone's forgotten what happened 200 milliseconds ago. Or of course, if you configure the on the wrong end and you try to make very sure that no one forgets anything, then everyone's shouting again. Doesn't help anyone, right? So that's one of the ideas we have. To be honest, this is a theorist going a little bit beyond what biologists currently believe. They're not telling me it's completely impossible, but it's definitely with current techniques, I'm pretty sure that this mechanism, if it were there, it would be difficult to see. That has to do with a bunch of details of how biologists actually do the experiments. So we think it's biophysically in principle possible to have this. It would be computationally super useful to have this for these types of tasks, specifically to deal with time as the thing that on the one hand gives you lots of information in the order, but also constrains your computation because you have to make sure that all the information that you need for a computation is there at a given time. But if you talk to a digital circuit designer that works on CPUs or something like that, right, they will really make sure that they have all the right information in front of a circuit that, I don't know, an adder or something like that, to then do the add, right? So they make sure that there are clock signals all over the place, or they have very defined sequential things that they know can trigger each other directly to make sure that if they do a computation in the digital circuit, it's the right kind of computation, right? The computation only makes sense if you combine the right information. Yeah.
You just now mentioned like biological research, and I always find it quite fascinating how these two relate to one another, and what's your perspective on this? Because I have heard like this somehow then inspires back like biology, or maybe like artificial intelligence and the research can be used later or further down the road to then improve again AI research. Like, how do you see the connection? Do you think like everything influences each other, or is there like a very directed connection?
There's no one answer to that question, and it very much depends on who you're talking to. One extreme case, for example, would be Konrad Körding. I'm not sure if you could get him on the podcast. He has at least some connections to the Institute as well, via Peter Koenig. I'm not sure how much he believes it, but at least the two times I've met him, he had very strong opinions that basically you should look at the brain as a black box anyways, and you shouldn't model any of the details anymore, because if you try to model the details, you don't learn anything, so it's not very useful, right? So he is on the extreme, and there's at least a position that he likes to take when having a discussion or an argument. Whereas on the other hand, you will certainly find people that, because of the disconnect between biological reality and what a deep neural network, for example, this black box model where you don't really know what's happening inside, is pretty big. There's really no point in following this further because the models are too far apart already, right? So the deep learner, for a while ago, Jan LeCun argued for maybe you should stop calling it neural networks and deep learning. Maybe you should just start calling it differentiable programming, right? Because you're writing a program where you can differentiate with respect to parameters and then optimize that program. So stop calling it a neural network. Right? And that's from someone who's, he's the head of AI research at Meta, right? He's one of the founding fathers of the field, right? So all these positions exist at the same time. In my experience, I think there's most people that are really interested in machine learning aren't that interested in biology anymore. And to some degree, for a good reason, because if you're trying to solve a problem, you don't want to bind your hands before trying to solve that, right? And if you want to put a lot of biological detail into your model, it might just be you binding your hands and feet together before you start walking. Well, it's going to be a lot harder, right? And on the biologist side, there's at the very least a lot of fascination with what's happening in AI. They're certainly trying to relate to that. And I think lots of interesting research will come out of this intersection, because the thing that sort of pure modeling of biology sometimes has trouble with is really connecting it to something like computation or cognition or anything like that, which is ultimately, of course, the goal. But if you're never solving a task with your model, for example, if you can't learn something sensible in your model and you can only describe what's happening in the biophysical reality, you have a descriptive model again, but it's very difficult to generate explanations, right? So I think there are people on all sides of the fence, and lots of people are quite close to the fence with very different perspectives, even though the extremes exist too. So I think it would be fruitful. There's another point that I think I'm involved with a little bit, but not really on the neuroscience side at the moment. I think AI can also just be a very useful tool for scientists, right? So the complexity of the brain is utterly staggering. Experiments are incredibly complicated. In March, I spent a week basically talking to almost only very advanced, sort of very cool people from very cool labs that all do neurobiological experiments. It's incredible how difficult it is, right? And there's no flip switch there to just do an AI model and then suddenly this will now work or it will be easier, something like that. There's not a one-to-one relationship. But I think there will be problems where AI can sort of start providing tools, right? The type of thing you would go for is what Demis Hassabis got the Nobel Prize for, right? For AlphaFold, right? There's nothing exactly like that problem, right? This folding problem has a particular kind of structure that was particularly amenable to this AlphaGo type reinforcement learning and sort of self-testing. And that, so it's not a one-to-one copy, but we're certainly also looking out for trying to make life easier for scientists to get more data or to learn more from the data that we get, because it's very difficult to get it, specifically on the neurobiological side where you do people are actually managing to record from single neurons that stretch over in an animal, maybe between 300 and 500 micrometers during behavior, right? So there's a mouse running on a treadmill and you're imaging a single neuron. And that's completely incredible. And there's no direct answer, AI will help you in this way, but possibly out of the data that you generate, maybe AI can help get a little bit more out of that, something like that. So that's a different side where I think people are also investigating this connection, where there can be a fruitful connection, just not on the modeling side, but also on the methodological side, possibly.
I was wondering, are there limitations in how you would develop algorithms based on the hardware we currently have available? Because hardware we have is different to the brain structure just by nature.
Yep.
And I was wondering, are there new hardware in development that are more brain inspired that might help for developing AI or deep learning algorithms that are closer to the actual brain? Is there just no way in doing so and we just have to work around and be creative with the hardware we have?
Both. The second point, specifically because developing new hardware is time consuming and difficult. You're of course right. So currently deep learning runs on GPUs or GPU-like architectures that can do lots of matrix multiplications at the same time, which work great for these types of models. And there are also spiking neural network simulators. So when you write a computational model, you can also simulate them on GPU. But they're still kind of inefficient, right? This fact that, for example, this EPSP that I talked about, spike that comes into the neuron, then rises and falls back down again. If you all want to model that dynamically, you need to step through time carefully, right? So to go through one cycle of computations, you will also already have a couple of steps of computation underneath it that just simulates the dynamics of that neuron. And for a simple, what we call a leaky integrated fire neuron, right? These neurons that just collect the spikes and then decide whether to generate an output spike, and that's it. That's relatively simple. But the second these dynamics become more complicated, you have to be more careful in the how many computational steps you do for maybe a second or so of neuron output. And that's quite costly. And it has to be done sequentially, right? And you cannot parallelize over time easily. And so that's trouble. And of course, on the other end, while GPUs, TPUs, and all kinds of accelerators are, of course, massively successful and are getting more and more efficient, they still are, on the grand scale, pretty inefficient, right? So the energy consumption of deep learning or machine learning as an industry nowadays is staggering. So those two problems come together and sort of give legitimacy to a field that I also am involved with, which is called neuromorphic computing, where neuromorphic means, well, it has a direct connection to hardware, right? And the idea is to build hardware that works a little bit like the brain. Originally, Carver Mead invented this when he was at Caltech in the late 80s or so, with a couple of PhD students working with him. The first sort of big thing they invented was an artificial retina. That's an image sensor that works a little bit more like our retina, which are now event-based cameras, right? They don't give you an image. They tell you when a pixel got lighter or darker instead, right? And it's a very different way of encoding visual information. It's maybe a little bit closer to the retina. And nowadays, the idea is to build hardware that's very good at, well, on the one hand, there's still the sort of traditional way of doing a physical circuit with electronics that has the same type of dynamics that you'd have with the biochemical electronic, in quotations, implementation in the brain. Right, so there will be a potential somewhere, a voltage potential that will go up and down, and after a threshold, there will be some other circuit that generates a spike. It will not be the same circuit that you have in the brain, because we cannot just put ion channels into next to copper wire that doesn't do anything. But it's sort of a semiconductor-based approach where you're designing circuits. And then on the grander scale, the idea is, can you build hardware that's very efficient at generating simulating spike in neural networks? And there IBM played a role in that. And so the internship that I did with IBM was working on the True North chip, which was one of the neuromorphic, was the neuromorphic chip from IBM. I think around 2016 is when they published it, maybe a little bit earlier. And they already got pretty big numbers. So they were able to simulate like a million neurons, I think at 18 milliwatts. And so I think that was their big paper, if I remember correctly. Which is, of course, in terms of like a million units in an artificial neural network, you probably use a lot more power for that. The problem is, of course, I think they emulated like monkey visual cortex, some similar activity patterns or something like that, but no one really solved any hard problems with these chips yet. Right? So that's sort of the dark cloud hanging over neuromorphic hardware. Hardware engineers are absolutely incredible, but they solve hardware problems, right? And they do not solve the problem of, can you get your spiking network to solve an interesting problem, right? And because it's neuromorphic, right, the idea is to implement as much of the dynamics or as much of the computational principles, not as a software program, but literally as an electronic circuit, or at least some resemblance of that. If you change your spiking neural network model, because you have a new innovation, you have maybe this dendritic plateau idea that we have will take off in 2-3 years or something like that, and that will be the thing that people do in spiking neural networks, well, then you need new chips, right? And then if there's a new innovation after that, you need new chips again, right? I think I like to compare the field a little bit. I'm not sure that people might not like this, but I think it's a little bit like fusion energy, right? Fusion energy people have they have one big advantage. They have the equations that show them how fusion works and what kind of energy they should get out of it. They also have this huge glowing ball of light in the sky that just demonstrates fusion. There you go. Lots of energy. We clearly also have the biological example of brains that are incredibly efficient, right? So a standard GPU on which you cannot run any big LLM, you can maybe run a decent image recognition program, will be like 200, 300 watts or so per hour. The brain is on 20 watts. So it's much, much lower energy consumption. For example, this idea of spiking, for example, means that you have to send a signal once, and if you're then quiet, and if there's lots of information in this one signal, and you don't need to send anything more, that's super energy efficient. Right? So it's one of the ideas that people follow in neuromorphic hardware, that spiking computation can, if you only have to send a few spikes, get you to incredibly efficient hardware. But we are sort of lacking sort of the equations for brain-like intelligence, right? We can't just write down the equations and say, theoretically, this is what we should build, and now we try to build it. Quantum computer people have the same problem, right? They have the equations, and they have theoretical algorithms, like Shor's algorithm or stuff like that. They can factor primes. And they now have to work on trying to implement that, but they at least know what they implement. And neuromorphic hardware, we still have a moving target because we haven't quite figured out how really good spiking networks work, right? So we're still trying to figure out how the brain works. It's sort of the same question from two sides of the equation, right? So that's, on the one hand, an issue. It's also exciting, right? Because there's still lots of potential for new developments. And because it's not a very clear target yet, there are lots of very interesting ideas in the space. Right? So, for example, we work with a group in Aachen who are implementing circuits with a device called a memristor. But typically in a electronic circuit, you might have a resistor that constricts current running through it, right? And you can do something like a multiplication with that. But the resistor, you typically have to pick a resistance value when you manufacture the device, right? At a particular milliohm or ohm level, and then you can't change it. With a memristor, there's sort of a way to either by increasing the voltage, or I think they sometimes also have an additional, they're called a terminal, but you can reprogram them, right? So you put them in with one resistance once, and then you drive a program cycle on that memristor, and then it changes its resistance, right? And of course, if you want to have a synapse, right, which is basically like a multiplication that is almost like a resistor, but now you can change the memristor, you have a memristor, you can change this resistance up or down, you might be able to do something like synaptic plasticity within a device. And hopefully at some point, this device will be able to be fabricated reliably in a very small form factor, so you can put it on your chip. And then this might be a way forward to have a very efficient synapse. This is also the device that we use to generate these plateau potentials when we're talking about circuits that use these plateau potentials. We're also using memristors there, right? But there are also other people who are doing photonic computation, for example. So they're trying to implement something like a neural network with light, with photons only, right? Photons have the great advantage that you don't need energy and they don't generate heat when you send them from one device to another, right? Different devices, new stuff, and all kinds of other ideas in the space. So I think the biggest segment is still trying to innovate basically on what kind of circuits you use, how you connect these circuits to other circuits. For example, Kwabena Bohen in Stanford, for example, is working on 3D integration, right? This is also already happening in the CMOS industry. So AMD is also already doing some 3D stacking, NVIDIA probably too, right? Where they're not just building a flat chip, where circuits are flat on basically a piece of paper, but at some point they're basically building small high rises where the circuit also goes into the third dimension. That's difficult to do. And the problem is, of course, if you don't have a flat piece of paper anymore, which you're drawing the circuit, basically with lots of simplifications here. If you have that, you can just put a heat spreader on top and take all the heat away, right? That's generated through the circuit. If you now have a 3D stack, the heat is generated within that. And there's no natural way to escape. And so there's a real limit of how much, let's call it activity in the neural sense, right? How often you can switch on and off circuit elements in there, because every sort of energy that you spend within the circuit will generate heat and the heat can't escape anymore, right? So that's a challenge for neuromorphic hardware, because the idea is, of course, the spike in your network, once you've figured out how it properly works, it will only send a spike sometimes. So there will never be many spikes at the same time. So the circuit that does your matrix multiplication, for example, which is now stacked in three dimensions, which you cannot drive with like one big vector where all of the units have to do something at the same time, only a couple of them will have to do something at the same time, will generate way less heat, and then you can go into 3D integration. And that's another one of these ideas. So there's lots of very exciting hardware ideas that sort of collide with ideas in spiking neural networks. And from the theorist perspective, right, so A, it's super exciting to work with hardware people because they have cool toys and they have a very different perspective on life and on science, and it's fun to do interdisciplinary collaborations. But also, if you're going to come back to this idea of how are you going to include biology in your model, right? And I said one of these things is if you're doing a learning rule, like plasticity, for example, you try to use variables that you know are locally available at the synapse or at least something like that to stay somewhat realistic to biology. Well, if you do one-to-one backpropagation, basically, in a circuit, every sort of spooky action at a distance where you have to know something about somewhere else in the circuit, you'd actually have to just lay down a wire, right? It doesn't magically get there because you're in a neuromorphic world. You're trying to sort of have some resemblance of the physical substrate to what the actual computation is, right? So where in a normal computer, we'd put a bunch of stuff in memory, you don't want to do that there usually, right? Or maybe only on a local specialized circuit. Instead, you just want to send information exactly like a neuron would. And if you want to keep something in memory, you either do a dendritic plateau potential, or you send something around, around and around in a recurrent network or something like that. That's how you keep the information, that you just implemented the network in circuit. And that means that all the information for a plasticity rule that's not locally available, you have to somehow get to that point and you have to engineer that, right? So it's a way to sort of keep you honest in a sense, right? this world also deals with, is I think the most active world when it comes to applying spiking networks to machine learning problems. That also keeps you honest, right? If you're a pure machine learner, most of the time the answer is not use a spiking network, it's use an ANN, right? Or a deep learning model, because they're just much, much better at the moment. Spiking networks are just worse in almost all problems. So you'd never find out more about a spike in your network, right? But if you're in the neuromorphic world and you sort of see the other advantages communicating with spikes might have, right? You have another reason to develop your spike in your network and to test it, because you're still developing towards an engineering product, right? A chip, a neuromorphic chip that's supposed to be applied in some context, right? You're supposed to be able to train it, or at least to configure it in some kind of manner, and then it is supposed to solve a computer vision problem or something like that. And so you end up training your spike in your networks, and getting improvements in the spike in your networks has real meaning, right? Versus if you're just generally in the machine learning context, it's a little bit, I mean, there's still lots of reasons to do it from a neuroscience perspective, right? From a pure science basic research perspective, we should really understand how computation with spikes works, right? But it gives you sort of this additional engineering perspective on that, which makes it very relevant, I think.
Thank you for that answer. I think it's very interesting. Unfortunately, we slowly have to come to an end. And I want to ask two questions instead of one. Like the usual question we always ask is, what is cognition in your own words, and what role does it play in your research? And for you, I have a second question, because you said in the beginning that you didn't like how biology or neurobiology was presented in school as like this thing, you have these ion channels and that somehow explains like thoughts. And I also relate to that disconnect. Has your research helped you maybe bridge that gap for yourself?
So I try to, well, I will comment on the first question and then I'll answer the second one, because that might be odd thing for someone to say who has a bachelor's and a master's degree in cognitive science and has done his PhD also at an Institute of Cognitive Science. But I'm really not quite sure what that means yet. I haven't quite figured it out. To answer the second part, I think that's one of my main motivations. I'd really like to figure out what the hell a thought is. And that's maybe a starting point to figure out what cognition is in the next step. I like talking to philosophers. I enjoy those sort of discussions. But in my mind, sort of there's a sort of background track going on. Yeah, I don't really. And for me as a person, I need to come at it from a different angle, right? And I need to, I'm not ready to just ignore what the implementation level is and ignore, for example, philosophers like to have this zombie argument, right, about whether an exact physical copy of you is still conscious. I mean, consciousness is another bag of beans anyways, right? But I sort of never understood what the real question is in that problem, right? I'm sure lots of even students here that are very into philosophy will not connect to my perspective on this, right? They will say, what the hell is he going on about? It's clear, right? To me, it's not. Because I think there's a very deep, deep connection of the system that implements cognition and cognition itself. Right? I think emergence is a word that gets thrown around, which might play a role. It's also not a very well-defined word. And so there are so many ill-defined words, and we do not understand fundamentally even how, like a fundamental unit of our processes in the brain, like a thought, what that even is. Right? I remember I spent a semester in Groningen studying lots of AI stuff. And that's actually when I got in touch with deep learning. Right? There was a lecturer there who showed us a bunch of lectures by Geoff Hinton at the time. And just before that, I saw his first Google DeepMind. Oh, it wasn't DeepMind at the time. Maybe it was Google Brain or just Google Research. I don't know what the Google subdivision was. I saw a talk of him there that was about his restricted Boltzmann machines, which was sort of the first big stepping stone towards deep learning. And then a second talk, I think around 2010 or so, which must have been around the time when AlexNet, so the first big advance in computer vision with neural networks, came in. And there he answered this, one of these vector, that's what a thought is, right? If you have one of these processing stages and it comes out with a vector with a bunch of, that's a thought. Not sure whether he would still agree with that today, but at the time I thought, oh, finally someone was telling me what the thought is. But now I have the same reaction to me in high school looking at my Burl. I thought, what the hell are you talking about? That is not a thought. And it's very clear if you use an LLM, right? They are all incredibly impressive and still get fundamental, easy things wrong, reasoning-wise, right? So there's no thought anywhere in those networks. There's a difference. There's a real difference. I'm completely convinced of that. And figuring out what that is like that would be a real achievement, for a personal achievement, first of all. But I think if I convinced anyone else of it, that would also be a big achievement. Right? So, but I haven't even gotten to the stage that I've convinced myself of what a thought is, right? So that's my long answer.
If someone has listened to this whole episode now and is going out and is a bit, well, full of information, what should they definitely remember after a week?
So the brain's a fascinating place that is much, much more complicated than basically we already knew it was complicated, but it turns out to be even more complicated. And the organizer of the conference on dendrites this year basically summarized it by, oh no, it's getting even more complicated. Right? However, that should really excite anyone that's interested either in AI, in neuroscience, in the brain or anything. There's so much more to discover, which means there's so much more left to basically figure out. And lots of very interesting ideas. Start reading.
Thank you so much also for talking to us and for explaining everything.
Pleasure.
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've listened to Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Clara Kühne, Imogen Hüsing, Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Lukas Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through Conversations on Cognitive Science. This podcast is not sponsored and does not give us any financial profit. If you wish to support us, the most effective way is to do so by leaving us an up to 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and following us on Instagram. You can reach out to us via mail, comment on YouTube, or message us on Instagram. We are always happy to hear your feedback. Thank you again for listening to us and for your interest in science. If you have any questions regarding this episode or any of our other episodes, feel free to reach out. You can reach out to us via Instagram by sending us a direct message at kaleidoscience_pod or write us an email at kaleidopod@us.de. You can find both links to our Instagram and also the email address in our show notes. We do read all your comments and will also reply to you as soon as we can.